Hey everyone, I am Reva and just want to take a moment and thank you for listening to our studio podcast. Although we are here in Greenville, South Carolina, we are grateful for your support to see the message of Jesus go out all over the world. In case you are not aware, we have a YouTube channel, which you can find the link in our podcast bio. We hope you enjoy this week's talk and it encourages you and it helps you to be the human God designed you to be. So with that, let's get right to it.
Good morning or good afternoon, which is it? I don't know. I guess it's at 12:40 is a good afternoon. Unless you're a musician, all the musicians, good morning. So since we're neighbors and we basically just live right down the street from you guys, like 3 hours down the street, we're just actually like 10 minutes off 85, so, but 3 hours that way. I think it's that way. It feels like it's that way. Yeah, is that right? Okay. My internal compass points towards home. But since we're neighbors, I want to tell you guys a little bit about what we do, so you understand a little bit what's happening up in North Carolina. And you guys truly do feel like allies to us. When Eric and Candace were like, we want to potentially move to the East Coast, they were starting to settle on Greenville, and I'm like, are you sure God's not saying Greensboro? It's really easy to just miss the Lord just a little bit, and it might be Greensboro, not Greenville. But they chose Greenville. And it's a joy, though, to only be 3 hours apart. We once were 3,000 miles apart, so 3 hours is a lot closer. But I want you guys to know what's happening up in North Carolina with the community that me and Melissa lead. We have a table up front if you want to find out more, but I just want to give you a little 5-7 minutes of what we're doing and the passion of our heart that will lead into a message. Me and Melissa met at ministry school back in the 90s. You guys remember the 90s? Anybody in here? And we both started ministry school saying, we're not dating anybody else but Jesus this year. And then I saw her brown eyes. And 2 months later, we were dating. Jesus was okay with it. And after 2 years of ministry school, we got married. And we joined my parents in ministry. And they had stepped out in faith and got this piece of property that they named A Place for the Heart. It's in Sophia, North Carolina, which Sophia means wisdom. And it's actually called the Heart of North Carolina. If you look in that area, it's called the Heart of North Carolina. And we're the dead center of the state. And the word Sophia means wisdom. We just got our first stoplight like 2 years ago. It was a big deal for us. Very small little town. But right there in the dead center of North Carolina, my parents established a place called A Place for the Heart. And when we had finished our school of ministry, we had just finished building our first cabin there on the land. And me and Melissa had a vision to start a summer camp. I grew up going to summer camp, and I got saved every year at summer camp. And when I got saved, I'm like, Jesus, I'm going to be the best boy there ever was next year. I'm going to follow you all year. And 3 weeks into school, I imploded every time. Because the pressure system of the world was greater than the pressure system I had developed at camp. And we had this dream, what if we could start a camp where our whole vision is not that they would just come drink from our well. Summer camps are amazing. You have those 1 week experiences. But like, what if it wasn't just about them drinking from our well, but we help them dig their own well of friendship with God, so then they can drink all year. And that they would be like the Daniels that go back into Babylon, and they have more pressure in here than they have the pressure coming at them. And they know how to stay connected with God. 3 times a day, Daniel's like, I got to get connected. I got to get connected. I got to get connected to maintain that pressure system. So we launched into our first summer camp with our first cabin. And the night before the summer camp, I was like, I'm going to stay up all night, Jesus, praying. Because that's what you did when you chose your disciples. It's not a good idea to stay up all night praying before you're about to host a bunch of teenagers and do all the cooking, all the cleaning, all the worship leading, all the preaching, all the stuff. It's just me and Melissa and a small little team of people. But I prayed to about 1:43 in the morning, and I finally fell asleep. And I think the Trinity was like, finally, he shut up. Like, we were like, how much longer is this going to go on? And when I finally stopped, I had a dream. And in the dream, I'm standing on a shoreline of an ocean. And I'm looking down, and I have this picture of my feet. And the water's coming right up to my feet in the dream. It's this very cinematic picture. And I look up, and there's an ocean before me. And standing in the ocean about waist deep is Jesus. And as I look at Jesus, I begin to feel waves of perfect, endless, liquid love just wash through me. And it's like he's looking right into my heart, and he says, I adore every part of you. And I'm looking into his eyes like a deer in headlights. I'm just caught in his gaze. And somehow his eyes are bigger than the ocean he's standing in. And as I look into these eyes of perfect love, I begin to see a reflection of more people. And I realize I'm not alone on the shore. I look behind me, and there's a whole army of young people. And I know in the dream, these are all the people who are going to come through the gates of A Place for the Heart in the future. And I see all the kids from the summer camp, but a bunch more people. And then Jesus looks at us, and I know in the dream, he's looking at all them the same way he's looking at me. We're all having in that personal moment. Only Jesus can do something like that, right? And then he has this mischievous Jesus smile, and he's like, come on, guys. Come into the deep. And we're like, who else has the words of life? We're coming. And we step into the water. And as we get ankle deep, he's a little deeper. As we get knee deep, he's deeper. As the water gets up to our waist, all we can see is his smile on the horizon. And the dream ends as we are baptized into this ocean with Jesus. And we're not dying. We're coming more alive than we've ever been as we go under the water of who God really is with him. We know that he's leading us into who his Father wants to be. And so the first night of the summer camp, I share this dream with the kids. And that week, Jesus just had a head-on collision with each of those young people and us as a staff. And we got to the end of that summer camp, and I remember looking at Melissa, I'm like, I'm ruined. Like, I want to do this the rest of my life. Set a table for people to meet with God. And more than just creating an experience, we did these things called worship commercials. We had 5 worship commercials a day because we wanted to advertise to them ways to get connected with God when they went home. And we just gave them all these are all these ways you can get connected. And I'll never forget the second year we hosted 2 summer camps, and we started having campers that came back. And we looked into the eyes of a few of these campers, and they made it through the school year. They were more in love with Jesus than they were at camp the year before. And then we looked at each other, and we're like, we definitely have to keep doing this. It wasn't all of them, but a few of them made it. And then after 7 years of leading that summer camp, our hearts started burning to have a longer season of discipleship. We're like, 1 week's not enough. We're reading about Jesus and his life-on-life discipleship. And we're like, what if we invite 8 of our favorite high school campers that are in college now? Because we're seeing all these high school campers get to college, but the pressure system of college was greater than high school, and it was crushing some of them. What if we help these ones that are in college, and on their summer break, they can have 60 days of spiritual formation and discipleship, and they live on the land with us, and they get deep discipleship? And so we hosted that school. We named it the 18-inch journey. So it's 18 inches from your head to your heart. And our passion then was to help a generation go beyond just knowing God here, knowing God in facts, but actually knowing God intimately from their hearts. Information is not transformation. If it was, we'd be the most transformed generation there ever was because we have access to all this information. But like they need an experience, a life-on-life experience. And after that 65 days, we're like, we definitely want to keep doing this. We just finished 17 years of discipleship schools. And we've had, yes, students from all over the world. And we have been able to host retreats now for any age. In fact, we have a few retreat alumni in the room, I think. I saw a couple at the first service. And it's our passion to help people make it for the long haul with Jesus. Jesus said, in this world, you will have trouble. Thanks, Jesus. He's like, but I have overcome the world. And this life is hard. There are high highs in this life and there are low lows. There's deep joy and there's deep sadness. There's tragic moments in this journey. And we want to help prepare people to make it with Jesus for the long haul. And that's the passion of our heart. Our songs have just been an overflow of what we've been pouring our life into in discipleship. I know there's so many songs we could have never written if we weren't like in the nitty-gritty of doing discipleship. Because it's discipled us. As much as the students need it, I need it. And the songs have been an overflow of that, a passion to help people stay connected with God. And so this morning, I want to share about walking with Jesus for the long haul, that at the end of our days, he would find us faithful, that we would be people that finish well, not like Solomon or Samson that have these spurts, but we would, for the long haul, have a long obedience with him in the same direction all our days. I want to look at this scripture in Hebrews 12. This is one of those scriptures that sometimes I just wake up in the middle of the night and I'm dreaming about, like, what does this mean? Especially this opening line. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. Does anybody have any heroes in that cloud of witnesses? I have some heroes there that I can't wait to say thank you to. Some heroes that I can't wait to ask some big questions of, who've pioneered and blazed trails for us. We are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race that's marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. He scorned its shame and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Put your hand on your heart and just say, heart, I'm not going to lose you. This is who you are. Proverbs 4:23, guard this with all diligence. And all the lies of the enemy are for us to doubt the goodness of God. Oswald Chambers said, the root of all evil is the suspicion that God is not good. I don't know about you guys, but even this week, I've had moments where those voices just come in and say, did God really say? Are you sure that that was a prophetic word? Are you sure that promise is for you? Are you sure you haven't done anything to mess that one up? Even this week, just that voice, like when you're in between things and things are hard, it's just like, you should just quit. It'd be so easier to quit. You guys ever heard that voice? We were with y'all's worship community yesterday, and I was confessing to them. I've had so many moments leading worship where I walk off the stage, I'm like, I never want to do that again. Or moments where I preach, and I'm like, I never want to do that again. See, I have double discouragement, Eric. You just get it with preaching. I have to face it with music and preaching. So it's not as fun as it sounds. But there is an enemy who hates who God created you to be. And he wants you to stop running this race. But there is a champion, there is a king, there is an author and perfecter of our faith, who Hebrews says, fix your eyes on him. Watch how he did it. And not only that, you're not alone. You have an army of prophets and apostles and saints who've gone before you who are cheering you on. I had a moment at one of my heroes' funerals. One of our spiritual fathers is a man named Don Potter, and his wife, Christine, passed away really suddenly, and it was a real surprise and was really sad for us all. And we're at her funeral, and Christine was one of the fiercest women I've ever met. When she looked in your eyes, when she looked in mine, it scared the out of me, because she had so much heaven in her eyes. It just pushed the lies out of your heart. And she said a lot of great things to me and Melissa. And she was a lioness. She was fierce. And we're at her funeral, and we got to open the service, and we're singing Raise a Hallelujah. And this picture of Christine is on all the monitors around the building. And all these people have gathered because the way Christine walked with Jesus changed us all. And I'm just trying to sing this song and not lose it. And I open my eyes and I see Christine's picture on the back wall. And I don't know if I imagined this, but it was so loud inside my heart. She's like looking at me like that. And she looks at me and says, Jonathan, are you going to spend your whole life caring about what people think about you? And Christine had this really sassy way of like rebuking you. And she's like, are you going to spend your whole life caring what people think about you? Or are you going to become the man God dreamed you to be? And I'm like, you've only been in heaven 3 days and you're already rebuking me. We are surrounded by a great cloud. I want to read the scripture one more time. In Hebrews, Jesus faced these same accusations that we face. After he's baptized and the Father says, this is my beloved Son, what's the first thing the enemy says to him after this moment of just being celebrated? It's in Matthew 4, if you are the Son of God, turn the stones to bread. Wait, the Father just said this, and the very opposite he comes to question, to see if he'll stop running the race and becoming the one God dreamed him to be. And you see that through his whole journey. And this is what the writer of Hebrews says for us to do so we might run this race for the long haul. This is from Eugene Peterson. Do you see what this means? All these pioneers to blaze the way? All these veterans cheering us on? It means we better get on with it. Strip down, start running, never quit. No extra spiritual fat, no parasitic sins. Keep your eyes on Jesus, who both began and finished the race we're in. Study how he did it, because he never lost sight of where he was headed, that exhilarating finish in and with God. He could put up with anything along the way, cross, shame, whatever. And now he's there in the place of honor, right alongside God. And when you find yourselves flagging in your faith, go over the story again, item by item. That long litany of hostility he plowed through, and that will shoot adrenaline into your souls. He's like, watch the replays. Watch the replays. Me and my wife have fallen in love with watching Steph Curry the last couple of years because he's changed the game of basketball. Like, he literally is a game changer. And he's an old man now. He's 37. And we only got a couple more years left with him. And my beautiful wife, loves to watch the games that she knows they've already won. Because we have, you know, you can record the games now. And we like watching them later because you can use your time a little better instead of watching all the commercials. And so we have like this little game in our house where she's like, I'm like, hey, have you checked the Warriors score? And I know if she says, yeah, no, she'll, or I'm like, do you want to watch? I don't know what I say to her. What do I say? Do you want to watch the game? And I know if she says yes, then they won. If she says no, then they lost. She's like, please don't ask me that. I'm like, I don't know what to do. And but then we watch the games, and there's something about watching a game that you already know the team has won. And all the discouragement you face in the other games when you don't know the outcome, it's like you're resilient to it. Even if they're down by 35 points. And there's some of these games, this last weekend they played the Spurs, and I was like, we got to watch this game. He scored 49 points. It's going to be awesome. And we'll like rewind and watch plays several times. You know, like, oh my gosh, he just shot it from half court. This is crazy. They're guarding him like as soon as he gets the ball. No one did that 20 years ago. But we'll watch it over and over again. And that's what the writer of Hebrews is saying. Like, watch the replays. Watch how Jesus did it. You need to know how the champion, how the pioneer blazed the trail so you can be girded up, so you can be connected the way he was. Jesus stayed 100% connected to the Father. 3 years of intense ministry with high highs and very low moments. His cousin being beheaded. Do you think that affected him? He's showing up at funerals and he's having moments with his disciples that have to be absolutely frustrating. They're arguing about who's the greatest. He's like, guys, I wash feet and you're talking about who could be the greatest. He has to deal with the religious system of his day. The pressure system was magnificent, but he stayed connected 24/7 to the Father. He never lost connection. I want to look at two moments of his race. Two moments of his race, and they're right at the end, which is the most critical part of the race, right? You ever watch the relay races where they hand the baton? Like that critical moment of that last person getting the baton. These moments of him stewarding his Father's will, and he never drops it. He never loses it. And the two moments I want to look at are in Gethsemane and on the cross and how he stayed connected, that we would look at it and we would learn from it. There's these stories of the Midwest where they would get blizzards. Has anyone ever been in a blizzard? In North Carolina, we get a little bit more snow than you guys, but not a lot. I've had a couple moments where I've been driving and just like, it's a whiteout. It's a scary thing, yeah? But they have these stories of the Midwest where blizzards will come out of nowhere. And they have found people that were working in their barn when a blizzard was happening. And their barn is over here, and the front door of their house is over here, just like this far apart. And they found people who couldn't find their way from the barn to the house because the blizzard hit so fast and they were in a whiteout. And that some of them have died just feet from their front door because they get lost. And one of the things that they would do to prevent this from happening, and I want to show it to you guys, sometimes it really helps to see these things, is they would go and they would tie a rope from the barn door to the front door of the house. So when the blizzard hit, they had a way that would lead them back home. Jesus had moments where the blizzard hit, the lies of the enemy come, the pressure systems of the world come. And he had these ropes that would lead him back to the Father. He had these rhythms and these disciplines that would lead him back home. And so what would happen when these blizzards would hit, they would come. Imagine you're working out in the field and it just comes all of a sudden. And the house that was like 100 feet away, you can't even see anymore. And you're like, wait, but I tied a rope there. I prepared for this moment. They'd reach out, grab the rope, and the rope would lead him back home. And when you watch specifically these two moments, you see Jesus had been living his life preparing for these two moments in Gethsemane and on the cross, where he reaches out as the blizzard of all the lies of the enemy, all the pressure systems of the world. He reaches out and he finds a way to get back home. I want to look at these two things. I sometimes don't love the word discipline. Does anybody sometimes not love the word discipline? An incredible thing about discipline is it can help you do the impossible. Like right now, if I said I have a prophetic word that I'm going to run a marathon, someone gave it to me, and I'm going to do it tomorrow, it would be impossible because I have done no training for a marathon. What would make it possible for me to do a marathon? To begin to train, right? A mile, probably like a half a mile tomorrow, and then a mile the next day, and then I build up to get prepared for that race of 26 miles. In these two moments of Jesus' life, I believe he had been preparing for, he had been training for. It's easy to just think like, oh, he's the Son of God. Like, he doesn't need to prepare. Like, he just floated through it all, making wine and raising the dead and washing feet, you know, but he didn't even get dirty when he washed feet because he's Jesus. But you read the story and you see a full range of emotions with Jesus. You see him tired. You see him thirsty and hungry, but he never lost connection. So let's jump to Gethsemane. This is in Mark 14, 32 through 39. And we're about to see a blizzard hit Jesus. And I want this to inspire you that, because we're all hitting blizzards every day, especially with the noise. We're the loudest generation that ever lived with these things, yeah? Anybody ever got caught on a blizzard in one of these? I mean, just this last week, we released a new album, and I'm like, oh, I wonder how many streams our album has. And then I compare myself to someone else's streams. And I'm like, I should have never made music. They're doing so much better than me. God's blessing them and they're not blessing us. I should quit. And all of a sudden, the blizzard of discouragement, I'm lost. I don't know where home is anymore. I don't know which way to walk. And it just like that, just one scroll, and the blizzard hits my soul. That probably never happens to any of you guys. You're probably just always on your Bible app, you know. Watching Bible Project and The Chosen, you know. But me, I deal with this stuff. So Jesus went to a place called Gethsemane, which is the olive press. It's where olives are pressed. Oil is made. And he says to his disciples, sit here while I pray. And he took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. And he said, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch. Okay, pause. Couple things. Jesus knew exactly what was going on inside of himself. His self-awareness is at a high level. Augustine said, how can you draw close to God when you're far from your own self? So Jesus knew my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow. And he also knew I don't need to be alone in this moment. You would think the Son of God could like conquer this one by himself, right? He's like, no, I want friends to come pray with me in this moment. That should like obliterate the shame of loneliness you have and go, I was born for community and I was born to have friends that can carry the weight of life with me. Jesus couldn't even do it alone in this moment. He wanted and needed friends. And then he is like emotionally regulating himself. He understands that his soul is overwhelmed with sorrow. Like his window of tolerance is just being flooded. It's not that we blindly follow our emotions, it's that we let our emotions lead us to God. They're powerful indicators of what's actually going on inside of us. So he's like, I am overwhelmed. He's not in denial. He's like, I'm overwhelmed to the point of death. I need to be with my Father. I need to grab the rope and get home. Yeah. Pete Scazzaro says about our emotions. He says, the issue is not by any means to blindly follow our feelings, but to acknowledge them as a part of the way God communicates with us. Self-awareness, knowing what is going on inside of us, is indispensable in emotional health and loving others well. In fact, the extent to which we love and respect ourselves is the extent to which we will be able to love and respect others. Jesus felt his emotions that moment, and he let his emotions lead him to God. Chip Dodd, he is just wonderful. He says this, when you begin to recognize and listen to your heart again, it will recognize you and it will guide you to the place where you can start to live life in openness. This openness will take you to fuller, richer living through relationship. To acknowledge that truth is to become vulnerable to your heart. Vulnerability exposes neediness, and neediness can lead us to seeking and knowing others in God. Simply put, if we do these three things, feel our feelings, tell the truth, and give it to God, full life will follow, the process of life God created. So Jesus is feeling his feelings. He's asking his friends, and then let's go back into the scene. It says, going a little further, he fell to the ground, and he prayed, if it's possible, the hour might pass from him. And then he goes, Abba, the most intimate name between a father and his children. Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. What is going on here? He was just like overwhelmed with sorrow, and now he's like buoyant with hope. You see the paradox of this moment? He's like feeling the pain and the sorrow, and then he's down here, Abba, Father, everything's possible for you because he's connected. You can do anything, Dad. If it's possible, take the cup from me, but not what I will, what you will. In another garden, we listened to the lies of the enemy and we chose our way. But in this garden, the Son of God kneels and says, not my will, but your will be done, Father. In another garden, we listened to the lies and the accusations against the Father's goodness. And we ate and we agreed with another narrative. And we hid naked behind trees. But this son will hang naked on a tree. And he won't hide from his father. He'll say, Father, here I am. Forgive them. And Jesus is reaching out. And I believe he's grabbing hold of a prayer he's been praying many more times before this garden. Do you see how much this prayer looks like the Lord's Prayer? You guys remember the Lord's Prayer? It's this incredible, it's almost like a poem that Jesus gives to his boys when he says, when they say, teach us how to pray. And he gives them this very memorable poem that is quite simple. In fact, it's so simple that I used to pray this with my JV basketball team before we played games. I don't know if I prayed it from here, but we would all gather before the games, and we lost our first 19 games. It is like living in a blizzard when you lose 19 games. But on our 20th game, we prayed the prayer, and we went out there, and we won on a last-second shot from the other free throw line. The smallest kid on our team hurled this thing up, and we won the game. Only game we won that year. That's when I started falling in love with the Lord's Prayer. I'm like, there's something to this. But this prayer is so simple, but there is great depth in this prayer. And do you see the similarities? Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Jesus, Abba, Father, everything's possible. The prayer starts in worship. If you miss the worship part of the Lord's Prayer, you miss the whole thing. Because then you pray like a beggar, not like a son. But when you get the Father piece, you get everything. And you get access. And Jesus opens the prayer saying, our Father. I mean, this is revolutionary. Remember, what the religious system hated the most is he kept calling God Father. He's like, hey, boys, here's how you pray. Our Father. They're like, we're not supposed to do that. He's like, exactly, our Father. Our Father, Abba, Father, not my will, your will be done. And so Jesus, I think, is reaching into a prayer that he's been praying. Because watch this. He then returned to his disciples. He found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for an hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall in temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And once more, he went away and he prayed the same thing. It's a well-worn path between him and the Father. All right, here's a couple things to inspire you with the Lord's Prayer. Henry Ward Beecher says, I used to think the Lord's Prayer was a short prayer, but as I live longer and I see more of life, I begin to believe there is no such thing as getting through it. If a man in praying that prayer were to be stopped by every word until he had prayed thoroughly through them, it would take him a lifetime. Timothy Jones, to cultivate a deeper prayer life, all you have to do is say the Lord's Prayer. Just take an hour to do it. To this day, I'm still nursing myself on the Lord's Prayer like a child, and I'm still eating and drinking of it like an old man without getting bored. This morning, I walked on, is the swinging bridge, you guys have the Liberty Bridge, is that what it's called? I walked on it really early this morning. I didn't really know what the prayer of a Greenville. I just know I love this city because my friends love this city, and it's a beautiful city. And I just sat there, and I'm like, oh, I got this prayer. I stepped out. I grabbed a hold of the rope, and I said, God, your kingdom come in Greenville. Your will be done on this city, on earth as it is in heaven. We can't breathe heaven out until we've let him breathe heaven inside of us. And as we go and we begin to pray these prayers, we're inhaling this prayer that he prayed himself. Isn't it cool when you pray that prayer, you're joining with that company of prophets and apostles and saints all the way back to the one who first uttered the prayer. My hope's to be praying that prayer several times for the rest of my life and to never get familiar with it, but to constantly stay fascinated with it. Just the one line, on earth as it is in heaven, you'll never be bored with heaven coming to earth. We should never become familiar with that prayer. So Jesus has this rope in Gethsemane, and then let's jump to the cross. Jesus is on the cross, and the blizzard is hitting now. Listen to what's happening. Two rebels are crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you're the Son of God. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the king's elders mocked him. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down from the cross, and then we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants. For he said, I'm the Son of God. In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. From noon until 3 p.m, darkness came over all the land. It's intense, yeah? Look at these insults and the murder and the pain and the anger thrown at Jesus. And even in this moment, he's not losing connection with his Father. And from noon until 3 p.m, darkness came over the whole land. And at about 3 p.m, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? Was Jesus asking a question with those words? My God, why have you forsaken me? Or was Jesus making a declaration? He's in a blizzard, and he reaches out and he grabs a hold of the lyrics of a song that are older than anyone standing around him. Lyrics that his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather on his mother's side sang. These are the opening lines of Psalm 22, and everyone standing around him would know this. And here's the thing about Psalm 22, is it opens in a really desperate place. My God, why have you forsaken me? But it ends in a completely different place. Those are the best songs, right? They take you on a journey. I don't recommend the song Stairway to Heaven, but I remember hearing it when I was a teenager and not walking with the Lord. And I was like, whoa. Or Freebird. That was like, I grew up in the South, you know. I'm like, man, you start Freebird here and then you end up all the way over there. Psalm 22 is a journey. It takes you on this crazy journey, but it ends in a completely different place than it started. And Jesus is speaking the words of Psalm 22. Everyone around him would have known this. They grew up hearing this song. Many of them would have memorized every word of it. We're about to come into the season of being tortured by songs. We do this every year. Everyone signs up for it. It's starting earlier than it's ever started. Christmas songs. Does anyone ever, by like the last week of Christmas, like, oh my gosh, I've heard this song so many times. All right, so let me just sing a couple lines of a song you've heard your whole life. I won't even sing them. I'll just say them. The weather outside is frightful. I want to propose that when Jesus said, my God, you've forsaken me, the same way I said some pretty sorrowful words, the weather outside is frightful. And then merriment just filled the room as you begin to take the journey in the song. So maybe these aren't words of desperation he's uttering on the cross. These are words of a definite victory that's coming to pass right before them. Because these are the last words of Psalm 22. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring it to a people yet unborn. He has done it. It is finished. Those are the last words of Psalm 22. So that's a little bit of a shift from my God, you've forsaken me to. If Jesus needed the book of Psalms to get through that blizzard, how much more do we need this beautiful prayer book that's been put right in the middle of the Bible? We have 150 well-worn paths to get us back home. And in these Psalms, you have every human emotion, the highest highs and the lowest lows. I have a list of where David wrote a lot of these songs. This is just a small list of some of them. Just read some of that list and see if you notice a trend. He didn't write these in the palace, sipping a beverage and strumming his golden harp. He wrote these in trouble. He wrote these in tension. He wrote these in a blizzard where his soul needed to find its way back home to God, to remember who God is, to remember who he was. These are tragic circumstances. He's got a father-in-law that's throwing spears at him. That's a very awkward Thanksgiving meal. He's got a son in Psalm 3 that tries to push his dad out of the kingdom and take over. And he writes a song while he's leaving his house with his heart splitting wide open. And he's like, I gotta find my way home right now because this is hard. And we have this prayer book. And those two ropes I just want to inspire you with. You have the Lord's Prayer and you have these 150 psalms that when the blizzard hits, you can find a way home. I've had so many moments. I don't know if I would fully still be walking with the Lord or be in the worship ministry if there wasn't the book of Psalms. I've had so many moments when I don't know what to pray to God, but I go to this book. And it's taught me how to pray. Don't just read the Psalms. Let the Psalms read you. Let them search you and know you. This is what Eugene Peterson says about the Psalms. He says, it's easy to be honest before God with our hallelujahs. It's somewhat more difficult to be honest in our hurts. And it is nearly impossible to be honest before God in the dark emotions of our hate. So we commonly suppress our negative emotions, unless neurotically we advertise them. Or when we do express them, we do it far from the presence, or what we think is the presence of God. Ashamed, embarrassed to be seen in these curse-stained bib overalls. But when we pray the Psalms, these classic prayers of God's people, we find that that will not do. We must pray who we actually are, not who we think we should be. In prayer, all is not sweetness and light. The way of prayer is not to cover our unlovely emotions so they will appear respectable, but to expose them so that they can be enlisted in the work of the kingdom. I want to close with one more story where I got to see face-to-face what a long obedience feels like. And I have a hero named Gary Keller, who is an incredible Swiss man. And he just passed away 2 years ago. But I got to be at his 91st birthday, me, Melissa, and Cadence in Haven. Got to be at his 91st birthday. This was his last birthday on the earth. And the only thing he wanted for his birthday that night is he's like, I want Jonathan to sing me a song. I want to worship with him. The first time I had dinner with Gary, we were eating dinner. He's a very quiet man, but then so passionate. We're eating dinner. He hasn't talked like the whole meal. And his wife, Lilo, is wonderful. And all of a sudden, halfway through dinner, he goes, Jonathan, your heart is always singing. I can hear it. And so I'm sitting at his birthday party, this saint, 91 years old. Him and his wife have done beautiful things in Switzerland. They've pioneered the move of God there. And I'm sitting with him. And as I begin to play this song called Father of Jesus, I started writing that song at his church. Father of Jesus, bankrupted heaven, you gave your only son away. Tears just begin to pour out of his eyes. And he just lifts his hands. You can see in the next picture. Well, yeah, he's just worshiping the Lord. There's Lilo, his wife. 91 years he's been walking with Jesus. He's not familiar. He's still fascinated. That's the kind of person I want to be when I'm old. And so I want to close with a song, and I want to do two things. I want to honor those in this room. I see some in this room. You've been walking with Jesus for a long time. I just want to say that we're honored to have mothers and fathers in the room that have been walking with Jesus for a long time. Thank you. Thank you for praying prayers that have done things in this city that made it easy for us to just walk into certain things. This morning worship was so easy. It's not easy at all churches, not to, you know. Sometimes Sunday mornings can be hard. But you guys, like, you were just pulling heaven out. And I believe the hunger of some of the mothers and fathers in here is pulling that out. It's like the ones in the temple waiting on Jesus. So I want to sing this song to honor the moms and dads in the room. But then I want to sing this song for those that are younger. And I want to challenge you, what kind of worshiper do you want to be 40 years from now? And one of my favorite things to do as a songwriter is to take my theology and try to squeeze it into a song. One of my heroes is Charles Wesley. He wrote 7,000 songs in his life. He would listen to his brother's crazy, beautiful preaching. And his heart would burn, and he would take his brother's theology and he would put it in the lyrics so a generation could go from their head to their heart and discover who God was. So I want to close today with singing this song. And you're welcome to just sit. You're welcome to stand. You're welcome to kneel. But I just want to give you five to 6 minutes to respond to God and say, Lord, I want to make it for the long haul with you. Would you show me what the ropes are in my life I need that take me back home to you, that remind me who you are and who I'm made to be, that I would be the son and daughter you've created me to be.
Thanks for listening to today's talk. If you're interested in learning more about Studio here in Greenville, you can go check out our website, studiogreenville.com, and you can give us a follow on Instagram. Our handle is studio.greenville. Have a great week.